Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. This is Beth Bielo, and you're listening to the Introvert Entrepreneur Podcast. Thanks so much for joining me today. Do you have a message you want to shout from the rooftops? Since shouting isn't usually a way introverts communicate, we're lucky there's a more subtle way to get our message across. At the risk of generalizing, most introverts prefer to express their thoughts and ideas through the written word, preferably with ample time to process and refine, and some would even say obsess. Few communication mediums fit that criteria as well as a book. For many, writing a book is a fundamental business strategy, opening the door to increased visibility, credibility, and profitability. Others may want to leave a written legacy, sharing lessons learned so that others can have an easier time on the journey. My guest today is passionate about helping writers become authors and guiding you through the journey from idea to publication. Lori Helgo, PhD, is the author of Introvert Power, Why Your Inner Life is Your Hidden Strength, the first book to reveal that introverts make up the majority, rather than the minority, of the population. A psychologist of 20 years, Lori made more room for her own introvert preference by moving away from traditional therapy practice to focus on her writing career. In addition to authoring 5 mass-market books so far, Lori launched Book It Literary Consulting. Through seminars and individual consultation, she helps writers develop book ideas and take the steps needed to become published authors. Lori resides in Charleston, West Virginia, where she also serves as a clinical assistant professor at the West Virginia University School of Medicine, and she's also a frequent patron of Charleston's independent coffee houses.
Hi, Lori. I am so excited to have you here for a conversation about introverts and publishing.
I'm happy to be here, Beth.
Now, you know, you've written several books, and you were most recently the author of the cover story for Psychology Today, Revenge of the Introvert. And within that story, you describe yourself as a card-carrying introvert. And I love that expression. Did you always embrace and own your introvert personality?
I like that question. I always acted on that. And I think we kind of can't help that, which is a good thing. But I didn't always feel good about it. And I didn't understand introversion, extroversion, which would have been, I think, quite helpful. I grew up in a family of 10, very musical, loud, competitive, creative family. But I felt often invisible. And I didn't want to compete for, you know, the floor. So I would often retreat to my room and write, and I loved that. I loved my private time. But I think, you know, didn't maybe acknowledge how important that was to me in a real conscious sort of way until... after my first child.
That would be a turning.
yes, definitely. And kind of well into my career as a psychologist, when I recognized that I really, well, it was a moment I actually can remember quite well of being on the couch. I talked about it in the Psychology Today article and just saying it out loud that, wow, I'm really not liking what I'm doing.
That must have been, quite a revelation.
It was. It was such a, it was very liberating, but it was kind of a dangerous thought in a way. I had ample of student loans to pay off, and I'd invested so much of my identity in being a therapist. And it wasn't just, I mean, I loved the field of psychology. I came to love my patients, but I saw too many of them. And because I invested so much of my energy into each one of them, I was drained by the end of the day, and my own private life suffered.
Yeah, it seems like it would have a ripple effect for sure. And I can identify with what you're saying. Like, I can only have so many coaching clients in one day or even in 1 week before I feel like my energy is too drained, even though, because I think we want to be completely present.
Yes.
And of service. And so we're putting a lot of ourselves into it. And that means that a lot is being taken out at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that need to have space between things, between even words, space between, in conversations and between people we work with, so that we can kind of simmer what we've taken in and make sense of it, is so important for an introvert.
So yeah.
We're not processing everything as we go. Yeah, I think to make life fun. I like to, you know, have solo dates and go to movies and sit and journal or whatever, because then I can fully appreciate what it is I'm doing. I think sometimes people think of that as kind of a pulling away from life. I think of it as just the opposite. That it's when we become enlivened, when we really get it. It's like, oh wow, I just had this cool experience.
Yeah.
And that's different for an introvert, I think, and it's something that maybe we only, you know, only people who embrace introversion fully understand.
Yeah, it seems like what you're saying is very encouraging to anyone who has been challenged by owning their introvert preferences, that rather than seeing it as a withdrawing from things, to see it as a way to reconnect with themselves and with their environment.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what's the biggest thing? You know, you wrote the book Introvert Power, and you know, so I of course have a question about power, and it's a word that I love and use a lot, because there's so much that we do to give away our power, and not just introverts, but extroverts as well. But particularly with introverts, what's the biggest thing that you see introverts doing that diminishes their power?
Apologizing. And I think it almost becomes a reflex. And the example I give a lot is, you know, after work, a group of people are going out for drinks or whatever, and it's kind of, oh, come on, you know, this will be fun. And that group think that's there, and a cultural think that going out equals fun, party equals fun, is so ingrained that we're afraid to acknowledge that, no, that's not really sounding very fun to me. So it's more like, we apologize, oh, I'm too tired, and we make excuses, which diminishes us. It's the whole idea is that I am not able to live up to what, what would be the best thing for me to do right now. So instead, what if I said, oh, I'm really looking forward to going home tonight and having time alone, and stating it as a positive rather than as I am deficient. I'm such a loser. I'm too tired. Whatever,
right.
You know.
Right. Sorry to be a party pooper, but I have to leave, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And just that one change in orientation can make a huge difference. Because people actually can relate to it. We all have a little bit of introvert, you know, if we state it. Probably somebody can understand. Yeah, I've had nights where I want to just go home.
I had one of those events the other night, so it's interesting that you bring that particular point up, because I was at a gathering, and it was a lovely group of people, and we were having a very nice time, but we were in a space that was very acoustically alive. Let's put it that way. And as we got towards, you know, and I was there with my husband, who's also an introvert, and as we, you know, went on in the evening, and, you know, conversation was continuing on, I just reached this point when I thought, I'm overstimulated, you know, or I'm not able to, like, be here and enjoy myself anymore, and it's time to go. And I really had to think about, okay, so how am I going to say this? Because I know I'm going to be the first person and sort of giving my husband the look to say, so what do you think, you know, without saying anything. And, you know, so I was really conscious of not apologizing, not defending, but saying it in a way that was gracious and appreciative while taking care of myself.
A lot to think about.
Yeah, yeah, it is, in a very short period of time. So I think I just said, well, you know, it's time for us to call it an evening. And then, you know, of course, usually what that opens up is other people who are also ready to go. It, like, gives them permission to. And then they don't even have to think about the apologizing. So somebody sometimes has got to be the leader, and you offered some great phrases to help us with that. So I want to shift gears to a topic that I know that you're really passionate about, and that is turning writers into published authors. And I'm guessing that in the writing profession, and there are probably more than our share of introverts, and lots of them have book ideas. So how can you tell if your idea is actually marketable?
Well, first of all, there needs to be a market. If I wanted to just write the story of Lori Helgo, you know, the market would include my family, maybe, you know, some friends. There's not a lot of people, and, you know, I guess my name is a little better known now, but, you know, if Jane Doe or Lori Helgo just wants to write their story, and a lot of people do, and it's a great therapeutic thing to write our story. It's very powerful. But if that's all it is, there isn't much of a market. So I often have people coming to me with memoir ideas, and within that, embedded in that, they can reach a market. My story is Lori Helgo, an introvert who struggled until she recognized what that was and what a difference that made. And so then there's a market, because there's other introverts who have experienced this. So I think, and I remember my agent saying that when people look for nonfiction, which is my specialty area, they're looking for help. They're looking for something that will fill a need. So to take what you've got, usually there is a way to spin it. I believe each of us has something from our own experience, from our, whether it's our life experience, our educational experience, what we've learned, that if that is really drawn out and communicated well, there is a market. There are people that didn't want to have to go and live your whole life to figure out what you figured out.
I love that. Yeah. Don't make them go through the same thing you did. Spare them the pain.
Exactly. And I am so grateful sometimes when I read nonfiction like that. I remember first reading Susie Orman. It's like, oh, you know, I wouldn't want to do all that, you know, learn all that about money. Didn't interest me, but I can just read her life experience and her professional experience and take from that. I think it's an incredible gift when we give away our lives so that somebody else doesn't have to live it.
And it reminds us, you know, sometimes we wonder, do I have a story here? And to remember that, you know, nobody else has lived our life. And so what can you mine from your experiences that will both be a gift and, you know, be a gift in the way that it saves others and helps others move through challenges or questions or difficulties, or gives them tools to help them figure it out when it inevitably happens to them too.
Right.
So you mentioned the agent piece, you know, when you were talking to your agent, and I want to come back to that in a couple of minutes. But I know that there's, I don't know if an agent has a role in both self and traditional publishing. Does a self-publisher usually have an agent, or is it just traditional?
Pretty much traditional. I think with at least I know there's more gray between nowadays, but in general, it is the agent that is the go-between between you and especially a larger publisher. They're the ones that know the editors and can help to fit you and with an editor, with a publisher, and sell you.
So I know that your trajectory was, the traditional publishing route, and that you are supporting other people in going that particular route. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between self and traditional in case there are people who are new to this topic? And what are the pros and cons of each one?
Sure. And I think that one thing I'll just say up front is that there are some self-publishers who have done beautiful work. I think what I get, I feel bad about is that some people just chuck the idea of traditional publishing because they think it's impossible. There's so much negativity nowadays about the publishing industry going down the tubes, blah, blah, blah. But it isn't, it isn't just a pie-in-the-sky idea. There's a way to do it. In terms of the differences, self-publishing is basically you buy what the components of the book. You pay for an editor, for the printing, for the, you work with distributors. You are kind of the CEO of your book. And now there are some self-publishers that kind of have you buy kind of the package. There's the editor and there's all kinds of things that they provide. But you buy it. And then the good part of that is, one, you have a lot of control over how the book is done. And for some people that really makes a huge difference. They want the book done just as they want it done. The other thing is that once it's paid for, the author gets the lion's share of the money for the book, the price of the book back. And as opposed to traditional, where you get a royalty, you get a percentage. The downside to self-publishing, of course, is one that it can be very expensive. And you have virtually no built-in distribution. And so you're basically peddling books. And some people are great at that, and they do quite well with that, especially if they can sell to an organization. A friend of mine did that and did very well. So, but there's myself, that would not fit for me. With traditional publishing, what people might see as a downside for me is a huge upside, and that is that you get a lot of help. You get experts. And when I wrote Introvert Power, I felt like a queen. I had a whole staff. Mm. I had, I don't know, like four tiers of editors. I had, there was cover designers. There were, proofreaders. There was, it was, and I didn't pay anything for that. I mean, I paid with, the ego risk of putting out proposals.
Yeah, I was going to say blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there.
You the level that you're held to is extremely high. But for me, that stretches me. My ego's been, my ego, there's not much left in a way, because editors are not always have time to say positive things, and they, they are there to do the red marks a lot of the time, but they make it better. And that, to me, is a gift, as opposed to total control, which also means that you don't get help. You can hire editors, and I think the people that have good, high-quality self-published books aren't just self-published. They do get good people involved. And then traditional publishing, of course, you don't pay except for blood, sweat, and tears. Sweat, blood, and tears. I always get the order wrong. But it's all there.
It's all there.
And you get an advance. It can be just a, you know, very small, or it can be large. And I tell first-time authors to expect it to be small. But that's nice, you know. It's a nice word to say. And then and the distribution is one of the biggest things, in addition to the help getting, you know, the book really polished, is that they have a sales staff that sell to Barnes & Noble, to, you know, the big bookstores, the independents that get it on Amazon, all those things you are kind of piecemeal with self-publishing. And so there's much more potential. There's a potential that it will flop, and it will get pulled off the market pretty quick. You know, it'll go out of print. And then there's a potential that it will just, you know, I mean, I have books published in multiple languages, and I didn't do anything. There was, you know, the person, you know, in the foreign contracts department just got contracts with, you know, Chinese publishing company and a Portuguese publishing company, and I couldn't do that by myself. So I'm a big fan of traditional publishing, and I think that it really it's worthwhile to at least put in a best effort to get in that door. I'm biased for sure.
Well, it's interesting, and I want to check something out with you, because I've been around a lot of people who are more biased, of course, towards self-publishing, like you said, because in the beginning, because there seems to be a lot of negativity around the mainstream publishing realm. And so one thing that somebody recommended at a workshop was, well, go ahead and self-publish. Just get it out there, because it can always be picked up by a mainstream publisher later. And at least then you've got the book, you've got the proof, and, you know, there it is. And it seems like that might be a good thing, but it also, of course, there's the flip side of some risk of, you know, what if it doesn't get picked up, or what if it performs poorly as a self-published book? Is it really going to increase the chances that a mainstream publisher will pick it up? So I wonder if you have any opinion about that particular piece of advice.
Well, I'm a little wary about the just get it out there philosophy at a lot of levels. I do think, I mean, there is some trend now. E-books are becoming quite popular. And there are strategies such as, you know, putting out a free e-book, or doing something like that, you know, publishing something and getting a distribution, you know, either, you know, putting things out for free, or getting something on the internet, and that can work. The part that always concerns me is the idea that you just that getting out there before you really, really make it good. I don't think there's an advantage of that. In that, I have people who want to just shoot things out to agents, and I say, you know, okay. You can do that, but you, rather than really giving yourself a fair shot, are kind of setting yourself up here. And any time that you want the public or the agent or whomever to do the work to discover you, to make you better, you're starting at the wrong place. And I've been through it myself, because even with an agent, you know, once I'm already signed on with an agent, she's not real big on me just shooting half-developed ideas and asking her, you know, to do work. Mm-hmm. I need to do the research. I need to, you know, really get a compelling proposal together. And if I sell it to her, she can sell it. But, you know, it's hard to put your best work in there, not knowing if it's going to go anywhere. But I would say even, you know, if you are going to go that route, and I think it does work for some people, of creating something, putting it out there, and using that as a stepping stone to something else, put work in before you put it out. I mean, I think what really, really sells is a great idea that is made to, in, that is communicated well. I mean, there's one is the great idea, but really deliver that in its living form, you know, in its, in the form that, the whole, you know, show don't tell. People just want more. They want more of whatever it is. Whatever you got, I'll have what she's having.
Exactly.
You know,
that's what you want.
You can do that. You know, the avenue may not mean so much. But I'm big on doing a lot of cooking at home so that the scent is out there instead of, you know, kind of, you know, putting out some ingredients and having somebody else mix it up.
Oh, great metaphor. Yeah. Like you said, nothing half-baked.
Yeah.
Because you want to make it, it seems like you want to make it as easy as possible for that person to quickly say, yes, this looks fabulous, let's run with it. And
right.
And be excited about it with you. And since nobody can communicate our ideas as passionately as we can, let's take that on.
And I think it, because it is, can be a lonely role to develop that, I think that's where I feel I come in, and I think, you know, a good coach or consultant can really help provide some intermediary feedback and help you feel like you have, you know, somebody who's in it with you, somebody else who is invested. I mean, I'm as eager, well, you know, just about as eager for somebody to get a hit as they are, because I've invested too, and I think that helps.
So you've talked about you've mentioned several times the agent, you know, and so the first question is, assuming a traditional publishing route, is an agent necessary? And if so, what is he or she looking for in a writer and an idea?
Right. Well, I think if you're going to get in with any of the larger publishers, an agent is necessary. There are publishers that won't even look at, unsolicited manuscripts or proposals. And an agent, for me, what is a plus about an agent is that that person is not just invested in my one book, but invested in my career and in helping me build my platform and all those aspects of being a writer and author. There are publishers that will accept submissions without an agent or editors that might look at, something, that comes from the street or whatever. but the other thing that agent does is that they help negotiate contracts. And it's much easier for an agent to be in a position to even know what to ask for. For example, you know, if maybe they can't get a larger advance, they can get a better percentage on foreign rights, or we can get you more comp books, or whatever. They go to bat for you, and it helps you maintain a positive relationship with the publisher because they do the dirty work. So I am, it's tough to get an agent. But once you've gotten an agent, you have really are adopting a career as an author, in my opinion, in my experience. Now, you also asked what agents are looking for, and I've talked to agents and, you know, read recommendations from agents, and what I hear over and over again is they want to be excited. They go through stacks and stacks and stacks of proposals, and they want to be excited. They want something to grab them and make them want to read it. So that, I think, is still number one. The agent who first signed on with me, there was something in my writing that spoke very personally to her, and she pointed right to it, and she wanted to know me. She wanted to work with me. It wasn't just the book. It was something almost at a soul level, if I can say. And so I think we have to remember that agents are people. And that's why I say, you know, submit widely, because you need to find the agent that this will speak to. Now, the other thing that agents emphasize more and more, and it's something authors often hate, is platform. You know, it's really convenient if you're famous, and most of us aren't. So, so there's an art to drawing on what you've already done, and then also expanding your presence. And it's easier now in a lot of ways because of the internet, but it can be very intimidating to people. So that's something I work a lot with writers in doing as well.
Yeah, and I want to hear a little bit more about the platform piece in a few minutes, because that's something that working with my own coach, you know, we've been emphasizing before even taking that first step towards agent queries. And it is a little intimidating, and it's even a little frustrating. And maybe I speak from my own experience, because I'm like, I just want to go. I just want to write. I just want to do it. And it's like, wait a minute. There's a lot of groundwork that has to happen before an idea goes to someone, because like you said, you want them to be excited. And my guess is a lot of them might be, even they want to be excited, and they're so, they're getting so many that it might be that 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 that really grabs them. And it seems like the more time you have to cultivate your platform and really put your stake in the ground, the more likely you are to be that 1 in 1,000.
It is a big advantage. And I think there's a balance between, I know that, yes, I relate to you that it's tough. I still, you know, struggle with it. But I think at times I'm so involved in the platform side and publicity that I forget to write.
Right.
And I think we need to watch the hype. There's a lot of fear-based messages out there that, oh, you know, if you don't do this, you're screwed. Mm-hmm. And so we're flittering around trying to Twitter and trying to blog and trying to send out a newsletter. And in the meantime, we lose our footing. We lose our – what a platform starts with. It starts with who you are, what makes you visible, and you can't lose sight of that, because if you're just talking and you don't have a whole lot to say, you don't have a platform. So I think it helps to be thoughtful about platform. And, you know, national platform is what agents love, and that can be very tough to establish. But I think, you know, I have one of my clients who is pitching, getting ready to send out proposals about her experience step-parenting, and she's hilarious. She's got a great writing voice. And but she is really connecting out there with step-parents. She's doing that on the Internet. She's doing... There's kind of a personal way she's connecting in a very kind of global or widespread market. But she's not on Oprah. You know, she's mostly on the Internet. But it comes just from what she's good at and what she likes doing. She likes talking to other step-parents. So, you know, I think it's less intimidating when we think of, you know, growing it out of what it is we, who we are and what we can offer. and then figuring out the ways we feel most comfortable communicating that, and, you know, being creative about it. And that's why sometimes I just turn off the hype, because it's, you know, there isn't one way to do it.
Well, you bring up an interesting point that what's going through my mind is that, you know, as an introvert, you know, if I was as an introvert writer, the writing part is easy, you know, relatively. Mm-hmm. That's my solitary activity. Yet when it comes to that platform building, that's like, oh, I have to put myself out there consistently, intentionally, with a clear message. And I know for some people that can be vulnerable and tiring. You know, to just keep it up. and that's before the book is written. You know, once it's published, you know, I've often heard, and I'm sure you've heard this too, you know, the birthing of a book is like the birthing of a baby, and it's yours for life. And even once it starts walking, you still are there holding its hand all the way.
Yeah.
Any thoughts, you know, for the introvert, who is, you know, looking at that platform establishment and whatnot about kind of how to protect your energy or how to discern, you know, the best approach? And I know I'm asking that and it's a very generic question, but I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that, preserving the introvert and energy in that process.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's very important. And by the way, I think you have a beautiful platform.
So oh, thank you.
I think we can be very hard on ourselves, too, you know, because there's all this, what I think of as platform guilt, and I feel it all the time. I'm not doing enough. I'm not Twittering enough. I resigned my blog because as an introvert, I also need a fair amount of privacy. And introverts like to deliver things in a thought-out form. We're not generally so interested in just throwing half, you know, formed ideas out. That's one of the distinguishing characteristics of an introvert. So, for me, for example, I, send out what I call wake-up calls, to a subscriber list. And they are just, you know, kind of thought, I don't send them out very often. I just send them out when I have an idea that I've formed, something I've figured out, and I send them out. And that's hit on something. That's, you know, people like that. But I don't, but it works for me because it is on my terms. I'm communicating the way I communicate. So I think being selective, and I don't think that is such a bad thing in terms of even becoming visible, because what I find, and you probably find this too, is that it's the people that I get 3 emails in a row from, you know, advertising something, even somebody I really like what they do, but they're flooding Twitter, they're flooding whatever it is with kind of bombarding you with a message. Those are the people I unsubscribe. Because I just can't handle it. I'm overstimulated. So it also would be good for people to understand the introvert market, which is half the population.
Right.
And Seth Godin talks about this in his marketing books about, the purple cow idea, which is that if it is something that stands out because of what it is, that is nowadays a better marketing approach than to just, you know, hit everybody as hard as you can. You know, who likes pop-ups? I think those have...
Oh, gosh.
You know, that kind of thing. So, I think, again, there's a way that introvert way kind of can automatically, in our cultural context, be dismissed as less effective. But I don't buy that at all. So I would say, you know, for an introvert to really find what it is that... what avenue it is that they want to use, and probably are already using in some form, and use and build on that would be, I think, more effective, you know, than just shooting, you know, stuff out wherever you can.
It seems like if you do what you enjoy the most, that's where you're going to show up the most enthusiastically and authentically to people.
Right.
And have the most meaningful connections.
And I do, you know, and I do want to say, because I'm always careful about, you know, trying to represent all introverts. I have an introverted friend who is a internet guru. And he has every possible social networking thing, you know, figured out. He's got all the, you know, streamlined ways of doing all this. And he loves it. And, you know, and so that's great. That isn't me, but that's, you know.
You bring up a great point. That's sort of a sidebar about generalizing about introverts.
Oh, yes.
Oh, gosh. It's so easy to do, yet we know that that we're all so unique. But there are certain things. And you know, I'm kind of one of those techie geek, love all the social media stuff kind of person. And so that sometimes runs contrary to the perception, but I also think, you know, the internet and those tools, like you said, we get to do things on our own terms. It seems like it allows us to reveal only as much as we want about ourselves, which can really be to our advantage if we recognize that and leverage it.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, you've kind of answered a question that I had about building the platform, which was, you know, is it quality or quantity? And it sounds like, if I'm hearing right, it's a balance of both. And quantity quality, you know, the quality of what you're putting out there to making sure you have something to say is really fundamental.
I think so. And you know, I think... who is it? Shaquille O'Neal, I think, that does on his Twitter, "Yo Mama," your mama. And I think that's a wonderful idea. And, you know, it's something that, you know, it's not just advertising. It's something that he, you know, it's fun. He gives, you know, puts out these jokes. I think he's probably still doing it, and I haven't. But just, you know, gone crazy. Of course, he's famous, but, you know, with followers. And I think that that's another avenue that can be helpful, is the idea of, you know, giving away content, not just, you know, say, hey, look at me. I know there was somebody I got in... email from that said, you know, help me make my book a bestseller. And I'm thinking, well, okay, you know, that idea of it, you know, that I'm asking you to do something, we're all pretty busy, and, you know, so, mm-hmm. I'm maybe getting away a little bit from your point, though, that quality versus quantity. I think, you know, I, of course, I'm big on quality, and sometimes I can spend an inordinate amount of time preparing things and before I put them out. But that's me, and if I try to fight that, I try to do everything, I'm just gonna, you know, be incomplete everywhere.
So you've worked with a lot of aspiring authors and writers, and I'm guessing there are a couple of times when you've just like put your hands to your head and pulled on your hair and just went to scream, no, when you see somebody making a really avoidable mistake.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, no, I can't, like it's in slow motion, you know, and you want to stop them. So what's, you know, what would cause you to do that? You know, what do you see people doing?
Well, my husband always jokes about when we have, ever since we were dating in college, you know, we've edited each other's stuff, and you know, where I would, I took one of his papers and like the first couple paragraphs, I just put an X through. And I see over and over again, I think we all do it, and I do it, especially in early drafts, is we over-introduce. We work around what we want to say. And I think it's very much like therapy. I, you know, kind of call myself the book shrink, because I like analyzing books and the way they're structured. And what people do with books is very similar to what people do at the beginning of therapy, is that they speak defensively. They actually, in often with the, what they're first saying is they're telling you how good it is. They're, you know, defending the work without showing you the work. And that is just, that's fatal if you're going to be pitching a book, because, they won't get to your good stuff. You know, they'll just toss it, in the reject pile. So, I work with authors to help them get, you know, what is that good stuff that you're trying not to say? And the other thing I noticed, it's more of a technical thing, but I think it drives me crazy, and I think it drives a lot of agents and editors crazy, is that overuse of exclamation points, capital letters, underlines, and they're all kind of saying, there are ways of trying to tell you that what I said is good, rather than saying it well. You know, it's like I'll say a sentence and then pow, you know, that was a really good sentence, don't you know, because I have an exclamation point at the end. Right. And, you know, and I do it. I mean, it's, you know, it's like, okay, so what is the exclamation point? What are the words that you're trying to say that would allow you to take away the exclamation point? And so when you, I think they can be clues to the fact that you have enthusiasm about something, but please translate that for the reader.
Yeah, I think about that Seinfeld episode where Elaine is, I think she's putting exclamation points at the end of everything that she's writing, or she's working with someone who's doing that. And so there's this constant punching of everything, like, you know, and I also think about, you know, the back of DVDs, when you're reading about the movie, you know, they go on this marvelous adventure. Woo! You know, it's just, so something about it feels a little lazy. So I really appreciate, you know, it makes you think, what am I really trying to say here? And what do I want to evoke? And am I over depending, you know, am I being overly dependent on these cues that get in the way, actually?
Yes, and sometimes it's as simple, you know, just taking away the exclamation point actually can make it more powerful.
Yeah.
It's a statement. It's not like, I had an English composition professor who said an exclamation point is a period with its head blown off.
That's wonderful. Wow. So, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm laughing now because, you know, the next question that I have for you plays right into this, which is, and the way I have it written on my screen here says, what can a writer do to create a book proposal that screams in capital letters, publish me, ! So what can they do that something that screams without caps and exclamation points?
Right. Well, and I like the word screams, because what are you screaming? You know, what do you want to scream to the world? I mean, for me, it was, I wanted to scream, you know, what is so great about parties? What is that? You know, and really a lot of us are not that big on parties. A lot of us really cringe. And so, you know, there are things like that I wanted to scream about, and I got to, because once you, I think there's also something with groupthink that, you know, if everybody's just kind of buying into something externally, but they don't really believe it internally, the first person who tells the truth, you know, the emperor's clothes kind of thing, has a great deal of power. And so I think, you know, yeah, what do you want to scream about? What do you want, you know, to say that nobody else seems to be saying that needs to be said? So I go back to get at your good stuff. Get internal before you get external. It is something that excites you, that makes your blood boil, or, you know, or you're extremely excited about, that kind of thing is more likely to excite an agent or a publisher than something that you just have made really nice and, you know, and logical and even well written without having life to it.
You're bringing up a word that's been living with me lately, which is fierce. And so it seems like, you know, I mean, to put it in the positive way of it's, you know, a couple of steps maybe even beyond passionate, because I think we've used the word passionate so much, it's a little diluted and it just means like I care a lot about it. Well, if, you know, sure, it's fine to be passionate and that's important, but it seems like for something like this, you've got to be fierce about it. You know, it's got to be something that you do want to scream from the rooftops, says the introvert.
Yes. You know. Yes, absolutely. I like that too, because we do get into these pet words that lose any life, and that's another good writing tip. But yes, I think Natalie Goldberg, I love the way she talks about this, and is it Wild Mind?
I think it is Wild. Well, at least I think that's the title of that.
Wild in it.
yeah, Wild Mind. I think.
Yes. But she talks about going for the jugular. Mm. And I love that. I mean, talk about a tangible, good way of putting it. And that, you know, that write what you're scared to write.
I'm literally getting chills as I think about that. Just when you said that, I just got this chill. And that's what it needs. It seems like you've got to have something that has that power behind it to really just go for it.
Well, and I think, you know, one other, as you said, that made me think too, when agent is looking at book proposals, and we know this when we're reading a book, and it says, yes, that's what I wanted to say. That's what I experience. When we can put into words, and we're honest enough to bring out somebody else's private experience, boy, that is when writing changes us. It interrupts our loneliness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, creates this this love affair between writer and reader. And, you know, if the agent's in love, I mean, that's when my agent said, I love your book. It's like, oh, yeah, you had me at hello.
Yeah, exactly. Well, music to my ears.
Yep.
So, you know, you're very experienced at this point, but at some time way back when you were a newbie, just like many of the people listening to this. If you know, as you reflect on your experience of being published for the first time, how would you finish the sentence, if I'd known then what I know now, I would have?
That's an interesting one, because what I come up with is I would have done exactly what I did. And I could only do exactly what I did because I didn't know what I was getting into. And what I did is I was determined that I was going to have a book tour. My publisher didn't give me one. It's becoming less and less common. And I did it on the cheap. I stayed with friends. I had, people in my writer's group, carpool with me, you know, drove from West Virginia to Chicago. I was very naive in a way. But I was a celebrity. I was going to do this right. I did the book signings. Now I know the book signings are humiliating a lot of the time. But I loved that I didn't know very much, because there's nothing like the first book. It's like, you know, first sex or first kiss. And I think there is a gift in being naive. And I think it's too easy to become jaded and forget just that it's wonderful to be published and that you are a celebrity because you have books on shelves, even if it's, you know, in the back of the store, you know, way up on top, and there's only one copy that hasn't been sold, you know. But you have, you know, it's just a huge deal. And so I probably, you know, from a logical standpoint, I put, you know, a huge amount of energy when one problem was is that the sales staff hadn't had success in selling, you know, distributing it as well as they had hoped, and that's not something I could do much about. But I was glad I didn't know that.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that about the publishing piece and your experience, and that you've offered some really fabulous tips and perspectives, I think, and things for people to chew on, especially people who want to be writing. And I think a lot of what you've shared here is also applicable to any entrepreneur, anyone who's just putting an idea out in the world. You know, you've got to, there's always going to be, you know, platform building to be done and people that you want to come on board with you. And so much of what you've shared is, it seems like, is transferable to all sorts of things. So thank you.
Oh, well, I enjoy talking about this, so it's a privilege.
So I want to ask a final question that I ask all of my podcast guests, and that is, if you were granted a year's vacation on Introvert Island, all expenses paid, but you only had room in your suitcase for 3 books, so what 3 would you take with you and why?
That is... I hate that you only give me 3 books, but...
It is only a year.
That's true. What I think about is, if I want books that will generate new things over and over again, I think of poetry, I think of Leaves of Grass, Walt Whitman. One book that I would love to have ample time to read and kind of unpack is, I've read it, but I think I haven't fully read it, mm-hmm. is Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf. She packs so much in that I think almost all of her sentences are quotable, but it's very dense. And so if I had time on Introvert Island to just sit around with mm-hmm. with that, with those sentences and spend a lot of time, I think I could read that numerous times and get a richer version of it each time. And then I think just for comfort, and you can tell the introvert, the theme here, Thoreau's Walden. Mm-hmm. I just find that so soothing, and I probably would feel like a neighbor being on Introvert Island while he's speaking from, you know, his place in the woods.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And so the first one you mentioned, Leaves of Grass?
Yes, Walt Whitman.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, again, I think with poetry, there is just, you can read it each time and have a different experience. With novels, a lot of them I won't read again, just because I know the punchline, and some I would read again just because I love the language, and but poetry is different.
It's so funny that you bring it up, because this morning I was enjoying my oatmeal and I had a cat on my lap and couldn't move, and I wanted something to read, and the closest thing was this Immortal Poems of the English Language paperback that I bought when I was 17 years old. So I thought, oh my gosh, I've had this book for 22 years and it's just carted around with me. And I read one of the poems I happened upon was from Leaves of Grass. And I was just really struck by, one, the beauty of it, the both simplicity and complexity at the same time.
yes.
And I feel like you sharing that is another sort of sign from the universe to delve into those kinds of things a little bit more, because there is a whole rich treasure trove of emotion and experience and perspectives to be gained from poetry. Because like you said, there's something different every time you come back.
Yeah. And I feel too that and Introvert Island would be just the perfect place to do that.
Exactly. You could really focus. No distractions.
Right.
So when you come back from Introvert Island, I'm sure you're going to want to connect with other people. And so I'm curious how people can connect with you and, take a look at what books you've got and what services you have to offer.
Right. Well, they can go to bookitconsulting.com, or if they have trouble remembering that, can just use my name, lauriehelgo.com. It all kind of gets to the same place. But my I do talk about my consulting services and seminars at bookitconsulting.com. My books, all that is on my website. Actually, there is a download there of the first chapter, I believe, of the book, so people can get a little taste for it if they want to do that before they commit to buying it.
Yeah, and I think I saw that. Was there an audio of that as well?
An audio, yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Great. Uh-huh.
Well, thank you so much, Lori, for your generous sharing today. And it's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you, Beth. And as an introvert, it's so nice to have this luxurious time to talk.
Yes.
I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Lori has made a generous offer to listeners of the Introvert Entrepreneur podcast. If you have a nonfiction book idea, send your 500 words or less description to Lori, along with a short statement introducing yourself. Lori will select one of the submissions to receive personal feedback. Just the process of writing your description and sending it off for someone else to read is a powerful intention you're sending out to the universe. So it's really a win-win. You get to put out your idea, and there's a chance that Lori will be able to give you some feedback. So if you're interested in this, please submit your idea to Lori at lahelgoe@suddenlink.net. So that's lahelgoe@suddenlink.net by February 24th, and she'll let you know if your idea is chosen for feedback. This is Beth Below, the Introvert Entrepreneur. I hope you enjoyed this podcast interview with Lori Helgo. To be considered for a personal review of your nonfiction book idea from Lori, send her your 500-word description and a short About Me statement no later than February 24th. You can send your submission to her at lahelgoe@suddenlink.net. So that's lahelgoe@suddenlink.net. To be notified of future podcasts from The Introvert Entrepreneur, you can subscribe to the RSS feed or visit iTunes. To find me, just type the word introvert into the search bar in the audio podcast section. If you enjoy these podcasts, I invite you to leave a review on iTunes and share these interviews with friends, family, and colleagues. You can also find out more about my coaching services, workshops, and speaking engagements at theintrovertentrepreneur.com. And be sure to join us for more community and conversation on Facebook at facebook.com/theintrovertentrepreneur. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to seeing you next time.